Today is Monday, October 4th, 2010. My name is Landon Stroblum with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. I'm joined with by a couple of my colleagues, Joel Miller and Girija Natarajan. We have Henry Tabe on the phone. Last name is Tabe, T-A-B-E, who's an expert in structured investment vehicles and can talk a little about the issues they faced in 2007. Henry, I want to thank you for taking the time today. Why don't you take just a brief minute and tell us a little about your background and your area of expertise?
Sure. Yes, Henry Tabe is my name. I'm a former analyst and managing director at Moody's Investor Service. I joined Moody's in 1999 and started working on CDOs and structured investment vehicles. I stayed in these two areas, but focused more on structured investment vehicles for much of my career with the firm. I recently joined or teamed up with some former Morgan Stanley, UBS, and Moody's colleagues to form Sequoia Investment Management Company Limited, which is a London-based investment advisory and fund management firm. So that's about myself. Let me talk a little bit about structured investment vehicles. This is an area that made a lot of headlines back in the summer of 2007, and that was due to a sudden and dramatic schism, I would say, in the market. The first vehicles to be affected were Civlife, which were cousins of structured investment vehicles, and the reason they came into the they came to the forefront was the result of some dramatic rating actions that were taken on this sector. The rating actions essentially followed the difficulties that the companies faced in refinancing their commercial paper obligations, and in some cases their repurchase their obligations on the repurchase agreements. So the difficulties that Civlife faced were the result of some precipitous drops in their asset prices, which simultaneously was concurrent with dramatic evaporation of liquidity in the market. So investors essentially stopped funding these vehicles, and at that point the vehicles tried to tap into their asset-based liquidity by selling assets, but the prices of the assets dropped so dramatically that they were unable to meet their obligations. In fact, they were in many cases unable to liquidate the assets to repay the maturing liabilities. The difficulties that Civlife faced were also faced by stable, traditional safe cousins in the course of the succeeding 18 months. And this was largely due to the longer maturity profile of the liabilities of structured investment vehicles, or traditional structured investment vehicles, compared to Civlife. Now, Civlife were the first to go, not just because of the short nature of their liabilities, but also because the portfolios were composed primarily of U.S. RMBS, not necessarily U.S. or prime, but U.S. RMBS. They did have some large concentrations of U.S. subprime assets or subprime backed assets relative to their safe cousins, but it was more the combination of US RMBS, a slight a focus, if you like, on subprime. By the way, the asset composition wasn't predominantly subprime. There were some CMBS. There were small pockets of CMBS. There were prime assets in the civilized portfolios. There were the so-called old A's, and then there were the subprime assets. But it was the combination of this evaporation of liquidity, which I believe was triggered by investor fear that these vehicles may have been harboring the so-called toxic assets backed by U.S. subprime RMBS. So it was this panic that caused the evaporation of liquidity from Civlite, and the traditional safe sector, although had very little exposure to subprime RMBS and CDOs of ABS, also became affected. Contagion risk meant that liquidity evaporated as well. Senior debt investors stopped rolling the CP and MTN, and the vehicles faced similar problems. They didn't immediately go into enforcement as the Civlites did, again because they had slightly more diversified portfolios. They didn't have and their portfolios were actually going back to the liability side. I'm sorry if I'm switching back and forth from the assets and liability side, but I think it's due to the integrated nature of the saves and save lives, the integrated nature of the balance sheets, where as the asset side is basically interacting intimately with the liability side. So staves had slightly longer liability profiles and slightly better quality assets. But the problems, the difficulties they faced were of a similar nature. I think I've covered the background, but if there are any questions, I'll be happy to take them now before moving on to perhaps what I felt, how I felt these vehicles were run, what I think the motivations of the different players were, and maybe mention some lessons that I think need to be learned from the implosion of the sector.
Great. Well, we certainly want to get to those points. I'm hoping that before that you could tell us a little more about the creation of CIVs and
sure.
Why then the market created CivLites, what they were hoping to accomplish, and how they accommodated for the risks of lower diversification and higher asset liability mismatch.
Okay. The first CIV prototypes were launched in the mid to late 80s, and my understanding it's only an understanding because I wasn't in the sector at the time is that investors were demanding steady returns backed by high quality portfolios, and the CIV business model appeared to provide both investment objectives. So capital node investors weren't particularly looking for. My understanding is that they had been burned in a previous crisis, and they were not particularly looking for spectacular returns. They just wanted top quality portfolios backing their steady, LIBOR-based, LIBOR plus 200-250 basis points. These are the capital notes or equity investors in the structures. And on the other side, at the other end of the credit spectrum, on the liability side, you had CP investors, MTN investors, looking to earn returns that were better than U.S. Treasuries for top quality or seemingly top quality paper. So you had some of the many of the large U.S. Money market funds interested in the product. We also had savings from the savings economies, if you like, of Asia, particularly China, Taiwan, Singapore, Hong Kong, and petrodollars from the Middle East, looking for homes. So the safe business model appeared to satisfy all these investors. In 1988, the first vehicle was launched, called Alpha Finance. Alpha was really a prototype because it wasn't an operating company. It had a finite life, and it didn't seem to size capital based on the risk factors present within the vehicle. The analysts and the pioneers of the business model and the rating agency analysts of all the rating agencies essentially came to a judgment as to how much capital the vehicle should hold. So they came up with a level of something like 20-25%, and that was practically it. No mathematical rigor went into sizing the capital. But the following year, the sponsor of the vehicle, Citibank, launched Beta Finance, which seemed to take the technology a little bit further by sizing capital in accordance with, I think, credit ratings. And this was quite a long time before Bal 1, I believe. Or maybe Bal 1 was being discussed at the time, I'm not sure. But certainly a long time before Bal 2, where capital was sized in accordance with credit ratings and tended to have a closer link to the risks involved within a structure. So that's the genesis of SIVs. Maybe I can skip a little bit forward to the genesis of SIVLite. They came to life in the last 3 years or so of the sector's existence, and the factors at play there were primarily spread compression. If you recall, there was a protracted period of spread compression from, say, 2004 all the way up to early 2007, or to the first half of 2007 before the implosion, and the search for yield caused CP and MTN investors to essentially continue to pump liquidity into the structured finance market. At the same time, CDOs CDOs in general and CDOs of ABS were also looking at the SIV business model as a way of raising cheap funds while purchasing the highest yielding assets in the market at the time, subprime RMBS or RMBS generally. It was both the highest yielding and the largest asset class at the time. So there was a combination of the SIV technology in terms of the issuance of short-term liabilities, CP in particular, and the CDO of ABS focus on US RMBS. But the marriage wasn't easily consummated, because the CDO of ABS if a city of ABS issued CPs, then it would have had to hold 100% committed liquidity, whereas the safe business model doesn't prescribe 100% committed liquidity because there is the concept of net cumulative outflow, which is a sort of dynamic calculation of liquidity requirements on the basis of inflows and outflows, inflows from asset redemptions and amortizations and interest payments, outflows from repayment of senior liabilities. So there was a marriage of this concept of what's coming in and what's going out over the next 12 months, and a sizing of liquidity to cover any shortfalls. So that meant the safe business model didn't need to hold 100% liquidity. So the main structure of CIVLITE, Barclays Capital at the time, saw the advantages of combining the two business models, and that's how the CIVLITE was formed.
So do you think that vehicle might be purely a creature of high liquidity, or indicative of extremely high liquidity in the markets?
Extremely high liquidity in the market. Yes, that creature. I think it would be. But that ignores the RMBS focus. Perhaps it doesn't. I mean, perhaps the fact that the vehicle was piling into US RMBS was also a reflection of the excess liquidity in the market, as spreads were very tight elsewhere. Yeah, so that may be a fair statement. Yeah.
Did its creditors regard CIVLITES as being more risky than their CIV cousins?
It didn't seem that way from cost of funds.
Why do you
they may have priced one or two basis points higher than their CIV cousins, but they were by and large in the same vicinity in terms of funding costs.
Why do you suppose that
pre-crisis?
Is?
I think investors had just stopped differentiating. Huh. It wasn't just between CIVs and CIVLITES. ABCP conduits as well were all lumped in, all structured. Apparently, all structured vehicles that issued CP appeared to be trading at about the same level.
Huh. Do you think that might reflect on the investor's capability to distinguish between the asset quality of particular CIVs or other ABCP conduits?
I think so. I think it does. Yes. But there, the differences are quite tiny. The largest CIV, Sigma, always traded tighter than most of its peers. Mm-hmm. So investors seem to the investors highly valued the fact that they knew the management, the vehicle had been around for a long, long time. It was more trustworthy, but every other vehicle that had that didn't have a strong sponsor seemed to pay a slightly higher cost. Citibank is a good example of a vehicle that was that typically traded very close to Gordian Knot, to Sigma, I beg your pardon. Mm-hmm. But I think most others were priced slightly higher than had slightly higher funding costs than these other vehicles, and investors seem to differentiate a little bit, not by much, a little bit between these vehicles.
Were investors capable of seeing the underlying asset composition of these vehicles? I mean, I know at an aggregated level perhaps it was very easy, but could they get detailed information, like CUSIP level information?
At an aggregate level, I understand investors that who signed, who agreed to sign confidentiality agreements with the vehicles, with some of the vehicles, did see the assets. Also, investors who, I think that was the main bone of contention, the signing of a confidentiality agreement. Some vehicles also were proactive. They supplied. Basically made their portfolios available on the web on a subscriber-only basis to investors who were interested. But the majority of vehicles didn't make that line-by-line detailed portfolio holdings information available to investors. And my understanding is that they feared that investors or the market could somehow get hold of their assets and they might be disadvantaged were they to have to liquidate assets. So that was one of the objections some managers put forward for not making their portfolios available widely.
So you mean that if another investor, I don't understand how they could front runner take advantage of the sieve if they knew that they had a common holding.
Mm-hmm. I think the argument was that being market value vehicles, the vehicles might be called upon to liquidate assets.
Mm-hmm.
And if the market knows what they're holding and how much they're holding, they might be disadvantaged. The market might. Yeah, I mean the traders they're dealing with may have a bit more information than they would like, and so may be able to take positions against them. That was the key argument. But the vehicles typically had if you took any two vehicles at random. You could easily find up to 50% overlap in the asset portfolio. So that argument is a little bit tenuous, because an investor who looks at one vehicle, one sufficiently large vehicle in detail, will have a pretty good idea what the other vehicles are holding.
Huh. In terms of specific CUSIPs or in terms of a type of security?
I think both. Some of the largest assets in, I would say that if you take the 10 largest assets in each sieve and compare them, you get overlaps of maybe 7+.
So earlier in this call, you mentioned that that investors were driven by fear that these vehicles were harboring subprime assets. Do you think that might have something to do with the lack of information that they had about the asset holdings?
It could do. But these were not the only vehicles that investors were shunning. Investors could quite clearly see what asset-backed commercial paper conduits were holding. Mm-hmm. They could clearly see what money market funds were holding.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, they didn't shower them with liquidity, did they?
One thing we've heard is that it wasn't necessarily the money market mutual funds per se, but their own investors that made it hard for them to invest in ABCP, because money market mutual fund got tired of telling its ABCP its investors that it was holding high quality ABCP, that it was hard to distinguish between high and low quality ABCP, and so the headline risk was something that they got tired of dealing with, and so withdrew from all kinds of ABCP. Is that something that you found true?
Yeah, I think that argument holds only to a point. We have to almost ignore the fact that liquidity evaporated market wide.
Mm-hmm. But what was driving the market wide liquidity evaporation?
I think it was the general fear that the fear of not knowing the true domicile of what investors had come to think of as toxic acids. And it didn't matter how much it didn't matter how much the rating agencies and the managers told them that they didn't have, there were not repositories of CDOs of ABS backed by RMBS, or they didn't have any direct exposure to subprime RMBS. It just didn't matter. It didn't seem to matter. But even vehicles that were posted their portfolios on the web were not spared. Vehicles that had signed confidentiality agreements with investors, so allowing the investors to see their portfolios line by line, were not spared. One vehicle that was launched, I think, in 1999, maybe 2000, I think it was 99, Parkland Finance, made a big deal of not buying any U.S. assets. It was a euro-only vehicle, and that's how it always stayed. I think it suffered a little bit in terms of its ability to realize its growth potential. It didn't grow a great deal because it was just a euro. It was a euro-focused vehicle. Also suffered. I mean, investors knew from the very beginning that this was not a vehicle that could have any U.S. subprime assets, mm-hmm. or even U.S. RMBS. But it, too, wasn't supplied liquidity. There was a run on the sector. There was a run on the alternative banking sector.
So that's a fascinating point. Once investors came to terms with the fact that subprime RMBS and everything downstream of that was no longer as highly rated as they had initially believed and no longer had faith in ratings, you sort of lose a sense of the boundaries of the impacted assets. Yeah. Is that an accurate characterization?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. You lose a sense of the boundaries. It seemed like total panic, essentially. There was there didn't seem to be any ability to reason and analyze the market. The market was just governed by fear for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. And banks also suffered, but they had access to the central bank lending window. They campaigned for a mark-to-market holiday for a long time and got one. They had access to the discount window. They had access to interbank lending. It dried up for a long time, and it was quite expensive, but it was there. In the case of SIS, which were, quite frankly, banks, they were just narrowly focused banks, there was nothing. Mm-hmm. The U.S. Treasury perhaps saw what was going on in November 2007, I believe, and tried to step in, but it was too late with its MLEC, the Master Liquidity Enhancement Conduit, I believe it was mm-hmm. called. It was too late.
So can you talk a little about the spillover effects from the SIV fallout and perhaps speculate ways it may have been mitigated, like you just mentioned with MLEC, but didn't come to fruition?
Yes. Some mechanism could have been put in place to essentially neutralize the mark-to-market risk the vehicles were taking. So as the funding dissipated, they could only turn to their asset portfolios, and the portfolios were dropping precipitously in price. So some way of essentially making that irrelevant for a while, basically providing them with some liquidity, some form of lender of last resort provision might have helped them. But the immediate consequence of that was of not helping SIVs was I would say, intense pressure on securitization as a whole, because SIS had supplied a couple of $100 billion, maybe even more than that, maybe $300 billion to the securitization market. They were real money investors. So their disappearance essentially created a massive hole in the global securitization world. And also, they had been funders to banks. They basically bought the lower tier 2 capital of many of the major banks. They stopped doing that, and the banks felt it. So the wave that resulted from the disappearance of SIS basically propagated around the market, and I believe caused many other structures to collapse.
Can you specify what other structures you're talking about?
I think banks would be the banks and securitization essentially, because those were their key funders. But the disappearance of securitization also led to problems with the likes of Northern Rock, banks that had relied heavily on the securitization market, were unable to fund. Banks also that had relied on, to some extent, on the purchase of their subordinated debt by SIS, also struggled. I don't want to overstate the point, because I think their contribution was small compared to what these banks got from the rest of the market, but it had an impact. It had an impact in draining confidence from the market. Had they stood up, had they been supported, they might have provided one stool for the one leg of the stool for the market to sort of pick itself up again and try and work through the systemic problems that had led to the difficulties they were facing. But the collapse of SIS and other structured finance operating companies, I must say, CDPCs were struggling as well. PermaCaps were struggling. So the collapse of the alternative banking universe had a devastating effect, in my view, on the rest of the financial markets, and as a consequence, the rest of the economy.
Mm-hmm. Is it fair to say that SIVs, when many of them were consolidated, restructured, I'm thinking of perhaps Citi in particular, these SIVs ended up not just hurting banks because they were no longer purchasing the Tier 2 capital, but also because many of these banks had to take them on balance sheet or support them in some way, and thereby occupying bank capital and perhaps also eroding bank capital in terms of the losses that they had to accept on some of the SIVs?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. The banks were not... if you recall, the banks... where rating agencies put out reports each time a bank took a SIV on balance sheet, essentially saying, you know, although the capital situation of the bank has worsened, and these were banks that were already struggling at the time, they didn't feel that the rating agencies didn't feel that the banks would be. The ratings of the banks would be necessarily significantly adversely affected, but they were affected. The capital situation of the banks were affected, and that meant they were struggling to lend. They were basically struggling to remain going concerns without state sponsorship. In many cases, so it was inconceivable that the SIVs themselves would actually go on balance sheet and then somehow come out the other way and be viable again. It was pretty clear that was the end for them. All those vehicles were taken on balance sheet and progressively wound down. So it was clear as the business model that was the end for Sims.
There was something you mentioned that there was a, I guess, a disconnect between the rating agencies and the actions taken by the banks to bring some of these vehicles on balance sheet. What would have been the cause of that?
Oh, no, I think there's a slight... Let me clarify. The SIP rating agency analyst thought it was a favorable... I think all rating agency analysts thought it was a favorable thing to do to take the vehicles on balance sheet. But the SIP analysts were able to affirm the top ratings, or in most cases, towards the end, it was the rating of the bank, because the SIP obligations ultimately were those of the banks that were supporting them. So the rating agency analysts thought it was a positive for that to happen, and in many cases, we also said, had the bank not stepped in, the SIP's senior debt rating would have gone to CA or C. The banking analysts, on the other hand, said, yes, the bank has taken on additional liabilities that were not factored in, were not anticipated at the time, were not anticipated at the time of the previous rating, but they've done the analysis and they see that, they can see that it's the capital requirements have gone up, the bank's capital requirements have gone up, but they haven't gone up sufficiently for the banking analyst to take any adverse rating actions. That's the point I was trying to make earlier.
Okay. This would have been in when? The fall of 2007, approximately?
Yeah, a lot of a lot of what I've said, I would say, spans a good 12-month period, but the events were triggered in the fall of 2007, yes.
So are there prior to that, were there discussions between those people responsible for rating the banks and those people who would rate the SIBs?
Yeah, there are always discussions within the rating agencies across the board. There are reports. In some cases, there are occasional meetings amongst the analysts. The most the managers, especially senior executives, there are always regular management meetings discussing the events and the salient features of any particular sector. So the different arms of the rating agencies talk to themselves. It's not the case that they each go off in their own directions and then find out later that one's taking action that may affect the other.
Okay.
So you'd mentioned one of the knock-on effects was its contribution to shutting down the securitization markets because SIBs were real money investors. So what effect would that have on the banks? Is that clogging up their securitization pipelines? And how big of an impact would that have?
The securitization angle, yes, that would have a big impact because I think it will have a bigger impact even than the actual amount of debt that SIBs bought. The banks or the sponsors of securitization typically sold off the top tranche and to people like to investors like SIBs, but the bottom tranche was also placed with some of the hedge funds, There's some other more opportunistic players in the market, but to the extent you can't place the largest chunk of the securitization transaction, the deal's dead.
So
the deal can't fly. But on top of that, on top of the, that clogging up of the securitization pipeline, you had the inability of banks to raise Tier 2 capital. Difficulties, because SIVs also bought a large slug of that.
Mm-hmm. So how did banks circumnavigate that?
I don't think they have. Huh. I don't think they still have. Many banks haven't. I mean, the situation has been the situation has been worsened for banks by the increased regulatory requirements under Basel III. So they're going to have to find new ways of raising tier two capital, and they're going to have to raise more core tier one capital now. So it's all a mess, I think.
Great.
So I just want to make sure that I have the comprehensive list of knock-on effects that you mentioned. And what I have here is shutting down securitization markets or contributing to that, a lack of funding tier 2 capital for banks, obviously banks having to now fund SIVs and taking some erosion of capital from the losses. And then I think you said perhaps most importantly, overall drainage of confidence from the market. Is that a fair list of knock-on effects? And if so,
I think you've covered it. Yes.
Can you help us size those and get an impression of which are certainly the most important and how they compare to other factors in this crisis?
Yes, I think confidence would be a big one. The disappearance of the securitization market, I think, would be another one. Loss of the kind of uncertainty in the banking industry, the nervousness, the difficulties the banks are facing in lending to businesses, many of which are viable. I think those are quite crucial knock-on effects.
Do you think that SIVs had any impact on a reluctance for banks to lend, not just to businesses, but to one another, for fear of hard-to-trace commitments in one another's balance sheets?
I can't see any direct linkage between the two. I think the linkage may be indirect in the sense that confidence had dissipated from the market as a whole.
One of the stories we've heard is that banks were reluctant to lend to one another, certainly because it was hard for them to trace out all the potential liabilities that a counterparty may have, but also because they were having a hard time getting a grip on all the potential liabilities that they would have themselves. As a consequence of all these commitments to shadow banking, or as you called them, alternative banking vehicles, does that ring true with you at all, or do you agree with that?
Yeah, but I think the liabilities resulting from the from providing support to their off-balance sheet structures. I think those were sizable. Mm-hmm. Those were easily sizable. I.e., they could figure out fairly quickly what they needed to do, how much they needed to set aside. Even if they had to make some assumptions about the likely destination of prices of the assets in these vehicles. But, mm-hmm. So I don't think there was a great deal of uncertainty, but there may have been some reluctance to admit that things were likely to get bad. So, for example, the pricing of mortgage-backed securities may have been done in such a way that super senior tranches were not really priced, were not really marked down. When, as time went on, some of the banks realized that they would be lucky to get 50 cents on the dollar in many of these so-called super senior tranches. So there might have been a reluctance to on the part of the banks to recognize how bad things would get. And I think many of the banks that proved more resilient than the others, I'm thinking of the HSBCs and the JP Morgan Chases, that were typically the more forthcoming in terms of making very conservative assumptions about the likely destination of the prices of some of the more I wouldn't say more toxic, but more distressed assets, if you like, or more distressed asset classes.
I see. You mentioned earlier that you didn't want to oversell the sieve story. Can you help us place it in a list of other factors that you think contributed to the crisis, perhaps in terms of importance?
I think Lehman would be, although Lehman occurred after the collapse of most vehicles, I would say Lehman basically tripped Sigma, which was the last independent SIV to collapse. I would place that as perhaps the biggest event. I think. It might have been just an unfortunate sequence of events that led to the demise of SIVs, but I think Lehman demonstrated that the crisis was much deeper than most people had feared. But SIVs can't be that far away out, I would say. Maybe second to Lehman would be the implosion of SIVs.
And then what would you place below SIVs? Perhaps third?
Perhaps disappearance of securitization.
Okay. You had touched on earlier that there was there's a wide range of riskiness in the sieves. I think you'd mentioned that there were several that that had highly rated securities. I was curious if you could talk a little about whether any were, you could consider them as collateral damage. I've heard from some people that that the Sigma Gordian Knot sieve was very well run, as well as the Citi sieves, and that perhaps they were just caught up in a liquidity crunch. Can you talk a little about that?
Yes, I think what I call the traditional SIVs, and although some people use the word traditional to refer to all non-SIV lights, I would exclude the likes of Cheney and Rhinebridge. I would exclude all those vehicles that were launched in maybe late 2006, all those vehicles that were launched in 2006 and the early part of 2007 were essentially like SIV lights. They had more appetite for US RMBS, and I'm not holding that against them, because that was the largest asset class in securitization at the time, and it would have been difficult to set up a vehicle without focusing on this. But the vehicles that were launched prior to that, I call them the first and second generation vehicles, so the likes of the likes of Sigma, Beta, Centauri, Dorada, to an extent 5, K2, Lynx, Parkland, Whistle Jacket, White Pine. Those were good, solid, traditional SIGs with very little exposure to US RMBS and US subprime RMBS. So they were largely, in my experience, they seemed like the most conservative asset managers you could interact with. They wanted to do things the right way. They wanted to make sure that they had covered all the risk factors and had sized risk in their vehicles to a super AAA standard. Managers were worried. When I first joined the sector, I saw people worrying about things that seemed extremely remote to me, things that seemed like they could never happen at all. And I remember going into an operations review and listening to the senior rating agency analyst asking managers to detail their contingency plans, explain what would happen if a plane were to crash into the tallest building in London, which was then the Canada Square. And this was in 1999 or 2000 or early 2000, so well before the unimaginable events in 2001. So these were the kinds of things that managers were required to immunize themselves against. And I felt throughout my experience in the sector that the managers had that mindset of trying to make sure that they minimize risk in the structures as much as possible. They wouldn't buy corporate credit, didn't matter how highly rated it was. They didn't like event risk at all. Many didn't touch US RMBS because they didn't like the adjustable rate. They didn't know how to hedge that, so they basically stayed away from it. They bought more Dutch, Australian, German, Scandinavian RMBS, and they liked banks, typically the AA banks, and they liked credit cards, auto loans, and some of the more solid finance companies, auto finance companies. So in my experience on the asset side, they were very, very conservative. On the liability side, managers tended to push out their liabilities. They would typically start with 6-month CP just to get them going and minimize costs. But as soon as the vehicle hit a certain critical mass, say a billion at the outset, but that soon rose to about 5 billion, they just extended the profile of their liabilities to try and reduce front-end funding pressures. So the traditional SIF would typically have a weighted average life of anything from 6 to 12 months. Unlike the SIF Lite, which had a weighted average life of liabilities of, I would say, 3 months at the most. So it wasn't surprising that when liquidity dried up and investors stopped funding, they were the first to blow up. Mm-hmm. My impression, just to summarize, my impression growing up professionally in that sector is that it was populated by some of the smartest people, some of the most risk-averse managers, which is all the more why when the sector went down, it was it was for me the most shocking event, I would say, in my professional career. I guess many will say things that occurred in the crisis were shocking, but I genuinely felt it. I just did not understand what was going on for a long, long time as vehicle after vehicle imploded.
How would you... So, let's say a hypothetical vehicles like Cheney and Rhinebridge were never launched. How do you think... some of the first and second generation CIVs that you were mentioning would have handled the crisis?
I think they might have handled the crisis in the same way they handled the crisis, the default of Russia and the downgrade of Korea, the Asian crisis and the Russian crisis in 1996 and 97. They basically suffered a couple of months, maybe 3 months of heightened funding cost, but there was no evaporation of liquidity. Investors didn't walk away. I don't know if it was because investors knew what the sectors were holding, or because they were not as much in the limelight, and so people didn't scrutinize them and ask questions that they found difficult to answer, that, you know, the investors themselves couldn't answer. But my impression in August, in July and August 2007 was that the sector would survive in much the same way it had survived previous crises. Mm-hmm. Portfolio market values had declined, but the way they hadn't declined by nearly as much as they did in 97, a decade earlier. So I felt they were doing fine compared to the previous crises, and perhaps in a matter of a month or two they would be back to normal again, and funding costs would return to normal.
So is that... Go ahead.
It's possible that contagion risk might have contributed significantly to the disappearance of liquidity from the first and second generation vehicles. As soon as it started evaporating with the save lives and the newer traditional CIVs, if I may call them that, I think the die was cast. It would have been difficult for investors to just stop and say, "Oh no, you're not CIVs. You are LPFCs," as Sigma likes to call itself. I think that was it. It was game over once the CIV light started blowing up, even for the traditional CIVs. In hindsight.
Even though, as you said, some investors did recognize the difference between the first and second generation CIVs and CIVs like Cheney and Rhinebridge?
Yes, some investors did, but the wave was very powerful. Mm-hmm. The wave, there were many more investors that didn't and didn't care. I think the media played a part as well. The media was quite happy to sensationalize the collapse of, you know, the next leaking sieve, or the next SIV positive institution. So it would have been difficult to hide, if you like. It would have been difficult for some vehicles to continue with their message of differentiation. They tried, many tried, but it just didn't seem possible.
So you had mentioned earlier that you had some specific things that you were hoping to mention. Feel free to go ahead with those if you see fit. I imagine we may have covered some of them here, but...
I think we have, yes.
Okay.
I think it's more... It's really the... the concept of treating alternative banks like banks, and stepping in if there's a run. That's basically it. I think that would, if there's one thing that would have saved the sector and much of the market, I believe, that's it. But of course, I think everybody had a hand to play in it. I wouldn't just lay this in front of the doors of the regulators. The managers themselves, they didn't they probably didn't do a good job in terms of transparency pre-crisis. Rating agencies, perhaps we didn't. You know, we didn't differentiate sufficiently. Perhaps we trained. We monitored these vehicles closely. We all assumed that that the disappearance of funding liquidity wouldn't necessarily coincide with asset liquidity. So the whole analysis of all rating agencies from inception is that on day one of the analysis of all SIVs, you assume that the vehicle cannot fund anymore. Okay, so the vehicle has to resort to selling assets. But that's only going to work if there's a market. If you don't have a complete cessation of asset liquidity as well. We've mentioned regulators, maybe the bank sponsors could have kept a close eye on the vehicles and tried to provide them with more liquidity early. Perhaps the vehicles themselves may have helped try to hold a bit more capital, extended their liability profiles a little bit more. But these are all, I think these are all secondary issues in relation to the role that regulators could have played.
And what would that role have been looking back now 2 or 3 years?
That role probably should have been to recognize the important, to recognize the importance of the sector, or the alternative banking sector in general. And I'm thinking of ABCP conduits, CDPCs, DPCs, all those credit vehicles that helped to boost securitization and to support some real economy companies like banks and even corporations. They might have it's a difficult one, but they might have recognized the potential for companies that perform maturity transformation to have a run on them, like banks do. If banks have a run and regulators do nothing about it, the banks go under. They may have, admittedly, many regulators didn't even know about SIVs pre-crisis. So perhaps the FSA's suggestion that regulators should take a more micro approach to regulation going forward might help, because then they would be in a better position to appreciate the potential impact of a sector on the rest of the economy.
I'm just thinking about the options that were available. Again, looking back, should the FSA or the Fed, do you think, have provided some direct support to these vehicles?
Absolutely. No question about it. Yeah. Yeah, I think they should have done that.
And why, in your opinion, did the MLEC not not get launched?
My understanding is that the architects of the plan were so focused on senior debt investors that they didn't try to win the buy-ins of managers and capital note investors. So the capital note, the managers of the capital note investors knew that participation in the plan would still mean the vehicle would be doomed anyway. So they didn't seem sufficiently incentivized to play. I think that's one key reason the thing didn't move. Even Citibank wasn't interested.
And why would they have been doomed if the support, if there had been support for the senior notes? Wouldn't that have helped these vehicles make it through this turbulent period, at least in the short term?
My understanding of the plan is that there was support for the senior debt investors at the expense of capital note investors and managers. Managers were essentially handing the vehicles over to the likes of BlackRock to manage it for the benefit of senior debt investors.
But yet, for this plan to go through, it required the consent of capital note holders and managers. Is that correct?
I'm not sure if consent was the. I don't think they even went as far as requesting consent. I think that the structure collapsed. The discussions collapsed at the level of discussion of how the structure would work. I don't think any sort of presentation was made to the managers and to the capital note investors to provide their consent. I think some managers were brought in to the U.S. Treasury for discussions, and my understanding is that the discussions didn't go very far. And that's another thing. I didn't take part in the discussions, so I didn't know what was going on. There was a SIV team with plenty of expertise, but we were never really consulted. I wasn't consulted. I might have helped, but they didn't think that. So unfortunately, I can't really say firsthand what transpired and what prevented the plan from proceeding. I mean, I don't think that it mattered very much who they talked to. Quite frankly, I think the fact that the managers didn't buy it, capital investors didn't buy it, meant the plan was doomed.
We're trying to understand the presence of fire sales, perhaps as they may have impacted SIVs. Let's say there was some hedge fund who liquidated a large subprime portfolio, and perhaps that had an impact on SIVs.
Yes.
And likewise, if a SIV went into liquidation, how did those asset prices spill over in a very illiquid market to other vehicles? I was just curious if you could talk a little about what you saw.
Yeah, I think that's really the starting point. That's how Civilized got infected. They had some of the same types of assets as the best ends funds, the variable leveraged fund and the variable leveraged enhanced fund that blew up in May, I think, of 07. There were already some jitters in the market about the delinquency rates, the charge-offs in relation to subprime. Repo counterparties to the best ends fund were demanding more and more collateral. And so the prices were heading south very fast. Some of these assets were similar after Taz was similar to what Civilized held. But even before that, the extendable CP conduits run into trouble. After the Bear Stearns funds, the extendable CP conduits that had funded themselves, they were the warehouse conduits. So they warehoused lots of mortgages and had funded themselves using extendable CP. All of a sudden, the CP stopped extending because the extension was at the discretion of the investor. Investors just stopped extending. So the CP, the mortgage warehouse conduits had to go and liquidate assets in the market that further depressed prices, and then Civilites also were impacted once the investors saw the Civilite prices collapsing. They stopped funding, and then there was a drought of liquidity market-wide for CP for CP and MTN. So the fire sale prices impacted Civs and Civilites at the outset. And once they started selling their own assets, I think the rest of the market experienced pricing pressures as well, particularly banks. As Civs liquidated their assets, and I believe because about 50%, 45 to 50% of their holdings were financial institutions, the liquidations of those subordinated bank debt caused further declines in the capital value of banks and caused the banks to run around looking for more capital. And, you know, it was just a downward spiral as further declines were observed in CIVs, and they had to liquidate their bank subordinated debt and structured finance paper. The market experienced even further price declines and further pricing pressures, and it just didn't seem like there would be an end to it all.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us an example of some of the extreme prices you may have witnessed?
Yes. There's one that sticks to my mind. There was a AAA RMBS. No, I think it was a CD of ABS. Yeah, CD of ABS. But obviously, CD linked to RMBS, US RMBS. When the safe bought the paper, it was assessed, and the vehicle decided that the capital adequacy, the appropriate capital adequacy for the vehicle, for the asset, was, I believe, seven cents on the dollar. So the company had to set aside 7% of capital. When this asset was liquidated, after the vehicle had gone into enforcement, the liquidator, I think they called it the trustee or the receiver got 7 cents on the dollar. So the capital was meant to be 7 cents, so which meant 93 cents was money good. The vehicle was meant to, in an extreme scenario, liquidate that asset and get 93 cents. But when the extreme scenario came, it liquidated the asset and got 7 cents. Which it was holding as capital.
How short a time period was that?
It wasn't short. It was, I think the vehicle, I remember vividly, the vehicle went into, enforcement on think it was October the 17th.
Of
a couple of papers went into enforcement on that day, so it's not going to be that easy to determine which one. But it didn't have to liquidate its asset portfolio. The trigger for enforcement, one of the triggers for enforcement was that kind of precipitous price decline. So it went to the market to get marks for its assets, and one asset that was, I think it was still rated AAA, had gone from a price of 97 cents on the dollar pre-crisis to the price of price of 7 cents on the dollar. Now, I don't think it was. Maybe your question implies actual liquidation. The asset wasn't necessarily liquidated on the date of prior to entry into enforcement.
But
that gives you a sense of the. A kind of price decline we saw for some top quality assets.
Is it so? Certainly, some of those assets experienced further impairments as some of the reinforcing factors and cycles came back and impaired the real economy and such later on in the crisis. So, in retrospect, we might be able to look back at that particular asset and say, well, it ended up defaulting on a massive scale anyway. But at the time, the prospect for the performance of that asset was probably still very, very good, and yet it was priced at 7 cents on the dollar. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially in cases where the ratings were still quite high, but the prices had basically collapsed.
How do we extricate the situation where perhaps investors anticipated serious losses and were right about it versus the situation where investors were just reacting and pulling back liquidity and there were temporary price impairments that weren't warranted from a credit risk standpoint? How do we tell the difference in those two?
It's ultimately quite difficult to tell the difference. Yeah, it's not at all easy. I mean, in cases where assets eventually, ended up defaulting or staying downgraded, in accordance with the price moves, one could say investors got it right, but for the most part, they didn't. For the most part, top quality current paying assets, which may have suffered one or two downgrades, were priced at significant discounts. I think the incidence of mispricing and panic in the market, in my mind, swamps those cases where investors made the right judgments by marking down assets.
Even in, let's say, July, there were some investors who were very vocal about their disregard for the rating agency's ratings. Is it possible that later on investors were still considering that and taking that into account when looking at assets that they may have had doubts about, but were still rated very highly?
Yeah, I think there are quite a few things in your question. I think rating agencies did get it wrong in many cases, and I would say in some cases, and I think that's also reflected by the mass downgrades that they eventually took. But I don't think it's fair to say that ratings, or to take the position that ratings should be discarded or should have been discarded by some investors. I think, by and large, ratings were still and are still a good proxy for asset quality, and in many cases for asset liquidity as well. I think in a functioning market, yes, they're good proxies for credit quality, and in some cases for asset liquidity. But rating agencies clearly got it wrong in many cases, where there was a disconnect between prices and ratings.
So then you would say the ultimate downgrades of many of these securities, let's say through 2008 and 2009, would be a direct result of reinforcing spirals, so to speak, as opposed
I'm
to...
I'm the wrong person to make that call, I think.
I see.
Given my rating agency background.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think rating agencies assigned their ratings and then subsequently found that the performance of underlying RMBS transactions were poorer than expected, and so they took their rating actions. But whether the manner in which they did so was right or not is something I'm not really qualified to say because of my potential impartiality in the matter.
I see. Okay. So I guess I'm still having trouble understanding what the... let me ask this question a different way. So when SIBs were created, the managers... constructed, or the originators constructed SIVs, knowing that if you could construct the liability side so that taking into account this net cumulative outflow concept, perhaps you didn't have to acquire as much direct liquidity support from a bank.
Correct.
As other ABCP
mm-hmm.
programs did, and so
correct.
If you manage that risk appropriately, you didn't have to pay for the support. And so there's this risk trade-off. But I'm trying to
yes.
understand how SIV Lights made some innovations to the SIV structure and where they thought their risk trade-off was occurring. Because it seems like, and I'm no expert in this area, but
they
it seems like they only increased risk. Is that...
No. Mm-hmm. They used the same NCO concept.
Sure, but in terms of the lack of diversification and then the shorter liability structure,
mm-hmm.
it seems like those,
well,
if you're going to take those actions, you have to offset them somehow, otherwise it's purely a riskier structure.
Not necessarily. Not if you hold higher amounts of capital.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And you hold higher amounts of liquidity. The capital was typically above 10%. SIV capital was typically around 7%.
I see.
So even though SIV Lights had OAAAs typically, they held high amounts of capital. And traditional SIV committed liquidity was 5 to 10% of senior debt outstanding. For SIV Lights, it was 20 to 25%. So, on the concentration side, it was thought that capital would address it. The increased amount of capital would address it. On the liability side, it was thought that the increased amount of committed liquidity would address it.
I see. That's very helpful. Okay. Henry, I know that you have a book coming out soon. I was hoping that perhaps if there's anything else that we didn't mention that you would like to get in here, we'd give you a few minutes to do so in terms of lessons learned or background that we need to understand about SIVs or just events that transpired.
I think we've touched on all the key players in terms of lessons learned. but I would still without trying to sell my book, advise purchase because of some anecdotes and stories about stories about the genesis and the evolution of the sector that I think might still be interesting.
Okay. And those aren't things that you'd be able to address with us on the phone right now?
I think we've touched on some of them, but it's a 233-page book, so there's still quite a few things that I won't be able to cover. We wouldn't have been able to cover in the call.
Okay. I was just hoping to get one concise, direct answer to a quote here that I have, I believe, from a July 20th report, 2007, from Moody's. And I'll read it to you here. It says, "Furthermore, the vehicles are not structured to forcibly liquidate assets in times of crisis, even in the face of a rapid and dramatic deterioration in NAV that results in an inability to roll liabilities. CIVs and CIV lights may, prior to liquidating the portfolio, draw down on committed liquidity, withdraw breakable deposits, and extract asset-based liquidity through the sale of short-maturity prime AAA credit card and auto loan ABS. This obviates the need to liquidate large buckets of assets at potentially the worst period in the life of the vehicle." I was just curious if you could comment on that and what we've learned.
Okay. I think what's going through the minds of rating agency analysts as they write that is quite a few things. First of all, if you have a period of intense liquidity pressure in the market, it's going to be short, as had been the case previously. So, if you say take the worst case, the worst liquidity crisis, or credit liquidity crisis, the longest, you'd give it maybe a month and a half, 2 months, maximum of 3 months. So you're saying, to the extent that the CIV were faced with an extreme liquidity crisis and it's not able to raise any funds, its NCO profile has been sized such that it will have at least 3 months to tap on liquidity that's already there before it resorts to liquidating its worst assets. So it draws down on committed liquidity. It uses other near committed liquidity products such as putable assets, where it basically pre-agrees with a P1 rated bank, a P1 A1 plus rated bank, to put some assets to it and get cash from the bank. There are committed repos that it can do with banks, and then there are highly liquid assets. There are some maybe not whole large buckets of U.S. treasuries, but there are some top sovereigns, UK, US sovereigns, so some supranational organizations like the EBRD and the World Bank and the African Development Bank, the top AAA guys whose paper will sell straight away. Then there are the sort of second tier liquidity buckets like credit card auto loans, credit cards and auto loans, AAA, short maturity, maybe 1 year, 2 years. I don't think those were as badly affected as other areas of securitization. So you're thinking of a liquidity crisis that lasts for 3 months. You know that these vehicles have sufficient liquidity to cover their size, their liquidity, their NCO profile such that they're going to be able to cover the worst one-week period over the next year with cash. They're going to be able to cover the worst two-week period over the next year. And the worst is actually the worst. You take, you can't, I don't know if you're familiar with the NCO calculation, but you roll the window and you calculate the inflows and outflows and you take the maximum outflow over the next year. That could be in the next 3 months, in the next 6 months. It could be any time within that window, but you have to hold sufficient committed liquidity to cover that. And then your most highly liquid assets combined with your committed liquidity need to cover you through your worst two-week period. And again, those could be at any time during the next 12 months. They're typically going to be within your within a three-month period. So you basically should have enough liquidity to cover you for at least 3 months. And many SIVs, many traditional SIVs survive for about 6 months before they blow up. So if this hadn't been an extraordinary crisis, that statement would have been in my mind, unimpeachable. It was the nature of the crisis that made that statement, in hindsight, ill-founded.
Thanks for that. That's a very enlightening response. So, given what you've said, are SIVs in any of the forms that they took, are SIVs sustainable business models?
Yes, I think you have to build in what would happen in the event of a run. That was absent. We thought a run would last maybe 3 months at most.
So when
Protective mechanisms when in the event of a run, I think it's a viable business model.
When would you say that the run started on SIVs?
I would say August. There were jitters in August 07. The managers were struggling to raise new funds. They were funding, but the cost of funds were being ratcheted up slowly and steadily. And I think by November, they were exorbitant. The vehicles could not afford the cost of funds because the portfolios weren't generating enough to pay what investors were demanding.
Mm-hmm. And again, you think that was because investors were having a hard time putting boundaries on the set of toxic assets that they believed were out in the financial sector, and in SIVs in particular?
Yes.
Okay.
I think so. At that stage, they stopped distinguishing.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else that surprised you? I know you mentioned a few things, or any other lessons that we need to learn from this?
I think the apparent opacity of the sector was a major disadvantage, and it wasn't just opacity, complexity to the general public. Many people within major institutions, some of them sponsors, some of them investors in large volumes of the product, rating agencies, many institutions just didn't know what SIVs were. That was a major disadvantage.
And what impact did that have?
Well, when it was time to make to take decisive action, the people who could do that didn't have the information. The people who could do that at all the various institutions were trying to figure out what these vehicles were as they collapsed.
And so by the time they did figure out what they needed to know, it was too late?
It was too late, yes.
What's too late for a sieve?
Too late would be when investors stop rolling. When the sieve starts looking for other means to repay maturing debt.
I've heard that
that's too late.
I've heard that at NAVs around 80%, sieves can still roll commercial paper, but when it gets down to, say, 60% or so, it gets very, very hard to roll commercial paper. Is that accurate?
I don't think so. I don't think it's related to NAV. I think it's related to investor confidence. In many cases, investors didn't even see the NAVs of many traditional vehicles. They just felt that the vehicles were harboring assets they didn't like and could potentially suffer from contagion risk as similar vehicles collapsed. I think in November, December 07, NAVs were still perhaps in the 80s, but people had stopped funding, I think, months before that. People were trying to do repos at that point. They were trying to put in place the ability to transact in repos and raise alternative funds that way.
Did you have discussions with money fund managers during this period? The investors in the
city. Some of them. Some of the investors, yes.
And I guess
I actually attended one investor meeting in London, one money market fund investor meeting in London. And my sense there was that they were not in control either. They were under pressure from their own investors who just didn't want the headline risk. Many of them knew what they were buying. Many of them understood the structures quite well, but they were under instructions from their own jittery investor base who were sort of tired of the headlines they were seeing in the FT and the Wall Street Journal and you know, all the news and all the major financial news outlets talking about this evil sieves.
About when was that meeting?
I think it was in October 07. No, I think it was later than that. It was maybe it was in 08. Maybe it was in February 08.
Thinking back, I guess, to summer and fall of 07,
yeah.
Did you have discussions with individual fund managers about sieves?
Yes, many called me.
And I guess
talked about sieves.
What were they starting to worry about? Was it, if you recall, what about the sieve concerned them the most?
One thing that stands out in my mind is the seeming pressure from money market investors for there to be more precipitous, faster rating actions, downgrade actions by the rating agencies, more than we felt comfortable with And I later came to understand that it was driven partly by the desire for the funds to get their sponsors to take out downgraded paper from the funds. So typically fund sponsors, money market fund sponsors would commit to removing downgraded paper as long as it's not defaulted, or basically buy out the paper from the structure and protect money market fund investors. So they were pushing more for downgrade because it was in their interest.
That's kind of a sad commentary. So the money fund managers wanted you to downgrade it faster so that they would be propped up or supported by their sponsors?
I wouldn't say that. Make it I wouldn't make it a very sweeping comment like that, because not all money market fund investors approached the rating agencies with that mindset. Many wanted to genuinely understand how we were analyzing the risks.
Okay, but there were some that had that mindset that,
yes,
presumably for the safety of their fund, it was best to have a sponsor step up.
Yep, and the sponsor would step up faster if the rating agencies say this is junk.
Henry, I think that's about all the questions we have. This has been tremendously enlightening. We really appreciate your time and your contribution. As I mentioned before on the phone, this recording may be part of the public record someday.
That's fine. I'm glad to have been of help. If you have any more questions, do give me a call.
Great. Thanks so much, Henry. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Okay.
Bye-bye now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.